Now we want to take a step back and talk about current deportation policy and where Howard Bailey's story fits into that discussion. Joining us from our New York studios is Muzaffer Chishti. He's a lawyer and the director of Migration Policy Institute's office at New York University's School of Law. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you for having me.
The Obama administration has called the deportation administration. Exactly what's our total now? How many people have been deported?
Well, in the last few years, about an average of 400,000 people are being removed from the United States.
There is perhaps a short window that might offer Howard Bailey help as they review the deportation policy. What exactly are they reviewing and what might change?
Well, you know, this Howard case is obviously symbolizes the paradox or the contradictions of our immigration enforcement system. Here we are removing about 400,000 people a year on average, and still many members of Congress are saying that we're not removing enough people. And here are stories like Howard's, which are really compelling stories, and we still think, some people think, we should increase enforcement. If we're going to have robust enforcement, which seems to be the cry from many people in Congress, then you have tragedies like Howard's. And we fundamentally changed our laws in 1996, even before that slightly, which has made it very hard for people like Howard, even with high equities like Howard, to get any relief in our enforcement system if they're convicted of a crime like this, which is called an aggravated felony in our law. So he has a lot of equities, even under the Obama administration's prosecutorial discretion guidelines. But he's also faced with the huge inequity on the other side, which is his conviction for a drug offense, which is made a high priority. So that's the contradiction as to how do you reconcile these two impulses in our immigration system today, and that's what leads to tragedies like this.
His defense attorney all those years ago advised him to plead guilty, not, I guess, understanding that that would scuttle his attempts to become a U.S. citizen. How common is that, that a criminal defense attorney doesn't entirely understand the status of an immigrant?
That's exactly the other contradiction of our system, is that when you have so many people in removal, you could have, many of them could have brush with our criminal justice system, like Howard did. And a lot of the people who represent them are just either pro bono, sometimes who are very good lawyers and sometimes not very good lawyers, who don't understand the immigration consequences. And they plead guilty without knowing what the effect of this is going to be in the future. The Supreme Court actually, in a very seminal decision, recognized that in 2010 and basically said that if someone like Howard has not been informed about the consequences of their plea, that could lead to ineffective assistance of counsel and violation of our Sixth Amendment. That's a huge seminal decision by the Supreme Court because immigration proceedings are typically considered civil proceedings. And our Supreme Court recognized that it's no longer possible for us to say that these are purely civil proceedings when they have huge consequences like this. So that would apply to him. Unfortunately, that decision did not apply retroactively by another Supreme Court decision in 2013. So he's not really, he has difficulty making that case that he is entitled to the relief under that Supreme Court decision. But a lot of people have ineffective counsel, especially in circumstances like this.
How many players are there in making these decisions? So, you mean, you mentioned the Supreme Court. Is it Congress that ends up having to make reform? Is it the Obama administration that has some autonomy?
Well, that's why it's a huge systemic issue. I mean, I think you framed it very well in your opening. Is this a failure of the system? Is it really how it was supposed to work? And the answer to that question is depends on whom you ask. If people believed that we should have scorched earth policy for every aggravated felony, then it's working well. If we believe we are in a country where equities of people should be considered, especially their ties to the family, to the community, to the military service that he rendered to us, those are important equities, and there has to be a place for accommodating those. Under our present system, there is very limited ability to do that. I mean, Congress in 1996 basically said people like Howard, who are considered guilty, convicted of aggravated, are not entitled to any relief from removal. That's a congressional decision. Hands are tied. Then there is some prosecutorial discretion, which I think could be improved in a case like Howard's. But that is also an uphill task, and that's where I think some of the review that the administration is beginning to look at may pave some good road for the future.
Muzaffer Chishti is a lawyer and the director of Migration Policy Institute's office at New York University's School of Law. Muzaffer, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
campaign season is right around the corner, and that means you'll probably see lots of political ads on a TV screen near you. And from time to time, I've heard campaign ads maybe stretch the truth or don't tell the exact truth all the time. It's been known to happen. Well, Ohio tried to put an end to that with a law that bans false statements about political candidates or issues during a campaign, and that law is now headed to the Supreme Court. We wanted to learn more, so we're joined by Sabrina Eaton. She's the Washington reporter for Cleveland's Plain Dealer, or so she says. She joins us by phone. Hi, Sabrina.
Hi, how are you?
I'm not trying to imply that you're lying about your title. We know that's true. But
anyone who Googles me on the internet could find that out. So, but, you know, I guess I could have mounted an elaborate plot and posted, you know, thousands of articles over the years just to convince you of that fact.
That would be going quite a bit further, possibly, than merits. But let's talk about what started this. And it was a billboard that claimed that Obamacare...
Well, it basically claimed, it would have claimed it. The billboard ended up not going up because the candidate at issue, a fellow named Steve Driehaus, who was a one-term congressman from the Cincinnati area, he threatened to sue the billboard company. And it would have said specifically, shame on Steve Driehaus. Driehaus voted for, in all caps, taxpayer-funded abortion. And in the Cincinnati area, that would be a bad thing. And this had to do with the Affordable Care Act. Groups that oppose abortion insisted that the Affordable Care Act would allow tax dollars to pay for abortions, and a lot of anti-abortion Democrats, such as Driehaus and Bart Stupak of Michigan and Marcy Kaptur from the Toledo area, they were very adamant that that not be part of the bill. And so President Obama signed an executive order that specifically said that no tax dollars would be used to pay for abortions, but that just was not adequate for many of the anti-abortion groups who were very concerned about the law.
But at issue here is whether or not banning campaign lies is in violation of the First Amendment, i.e., should we allow people to lie about politicians and politics, right?
Yes, and Driehaus filed a complaint under the Ohio law saying that this billboard would have violated that law because it was a lie. And, of course, the people who posted it, they did not believe it was a lie. And the Ohio law says basically that you have to know that the thing is a lie when you post it, and it can't just be something that, like, you think is true, but it happens not to be true. But the group that wanted to post the billboard, the Susan B. Anthony List, they went to court over it, claiming that Ohio's law was unconstitutional. And lower courts ended up throwing out the case because Driehaus withdrew his complaint against the Susan B. Anthony List prior to it being heard. So the Susan B. Anthony List was never actually adjudicated in violation of the law. So there was this jurisdictional question. And what the court may end up doing in this is saying you have to consider this, you know, even though they were not found guilty of violating the law. They could also, of course, you know, issue some sort of a statement about whether the law is or isn't constitutional, but often the Supreme Court tries to kind of be a little more narrow in its decisions and, like, toss things back to the lower courts, which some observers think is what will happen here.
Ohio is not the only state that has a law.
There's
like...
at least 15 others.
So let's assume that the Supreme Court does, in fact, decide to rule on whether or not a law like this is constitutional or violates the First Amendment. That would affect those other 15 states, would it not?
It would, as a matter of fact, yes.
So, I mean, I imagine that many people who look at billboards, are forced to look at billboards, have campaign ads coming through all the time, think it would be a positive thing to force them to tell the truth. Who is opposing this law?
A lot of people seem to think that it violates the First Amendment. The ACLU does. They filed a friend of the court brief to that point, and it's kind of interesting because the ACLU is very supportive of women's rights to, you know, abortions and things of that nature. And so they're in league with this group that is very anti-abortion and, in fact, was, you know, that was the point of the ad they wanted to do. And there was also a very entertaining brief that was filed by the Cato Institute and a humorist, or I guess he calls himself a political satirist, P.J. O'Rourke. It had a lot of, you know, extremely, you know, funny tidbits in there where they were talking about famous lines from that presidents had uttered, such as, I am not a crook, read my lips, no new taxes. I did not have sexual relations with that woman, and mission accomplished. You know, things like that, you know, I think that, you know, perhaps their truth.
One could argue that they're lies, but on the other hand, this raises a good question. What you have there, I'm not a crook, is a statement that, again, is up for debate. But
right.
Read My Lips, No New Taxes is a campaign promise. I mean, in order to find that to be a lie, you'd have to go back retroactively, right?
Right. And in fact, one of the other statements that that O'Rourke brings up in this is, if you like your health care plan, you can keep it. And, you know, that is a claim that the fact-finding group PolitiFact, you know, initially they found that it was true. But then subsequently, after the Affordable Care Act was implemented, you know, it was found to be false. So, you know, the truth and falsehood of some of these claims can just kind of, you know, evolve over time.
How has the law been tested in Ohio, if it has?
What happens is, if you're found guilty of violating the law, it's a misdemeanor, and you can pay, I think, a $5,000 fine, and I think there may be a shortish prison sentence as possible, but I don't know that anybody has been found guilty of that. I haven't really researched it much, but what this does is, I guess, it gives candidates a chance to bring up that they think something is false, and the people who place these ads, you know, and who insist that they're true, say that it has a chilling effect on their free speech.
But, I mean, that's kind of the question, though, Sabrina. What do you think the effect has been? Has it made people be more truthful?
Well,
she laughs.
I don't, you know, a lot of my job involves covering political campaigns.
Correct.
And I don't know that it really has had that much effect. No, and, you know, there's a lot of claims out there that I have felt are suspect over the years, and I don't know that that this Ohio law has really had much of a dent in it. I mean, sorry to say. That is my personal opinion, though.
Sabrina Eaton, a Plain Dealers Washington reporter. She joined us by phone. Sabrina, thanks so much.
Okay, you're welcome.
Last week, a bug called Heartbleed put the entire internet on alert. Tech companies that handle email and online bank accounts sent out ominous advisories, and there was a rush to change passwords. Now the bug has been cured, but the system it infected is still at risk. From member station KQED, Arthi Shahani reports.
OpenSSL is the software that got infected. It's supposed to be the really safe, secure road on the internet superhighway, where messages get encrypted and sent between users and servers. Fortune 1000 companies rely on OpenSSL for their core business. But no one is paying for it. Steve Marques is founder of the OpenSSL Foundation.
There's only one person who does nothing but work on OpenSSL in some capacity. Everyone else has outside obligations.
The recent bug was like a gaping pothole. His volunteer team couldn't catch it because there aren't enough of them to look. They get some money in corporate contracts.
Rather quite a bit, under $1 million.
But that's for company-specific work. In 2013, they got just $2,000 for upkeep. After news of the bug broke, one person on a popular tech forum joked, the software could raise more money panhandling in a big city than it's gotten online.
Seeking donations is obviously one useful path for getting support.
Ed Felton is a computer scientist at Princeton University.
But I don't know about standing out in the street corner with a tin cup.
Felton says OpenSSL is like public infrastructure without a tax base. It's open source, meaning anyone can use it for free. But it's so poor, it's never had a complete security audit. Two-thirds of websites rely on OpenSSL. In economics, these users are called free riders.
A free rider problem means that someone can benefit from a project or a technology without contributing back to it.
High-tech companies are keeping quiet about the software's financial woes. Facebook and OkCupid did not respond to NPR's inquiry. Yahoo, Amazon, and Google declined to comment. Cisco did disclose they do not give checks to OpenSSL, but their employees do actively help with code. Many cybersecurity experts, including Felton, say that's not enough.
Somebody needs to be paying and putting in the work to ensure that components like OpenSSL are secure. It's a job that some of the large companies could do individually or get together and do.
I'm not looking for bad guys here. I think it's more of an educational problem.
David Chartier is CEO of Codenomicon, the company that found the recent bug. He says the crisis is not a cautionary tale in free riders and corporate accountability. Software, public or private, will always have bugs, and people have to come together as a team to deal with it.
Never before have we seen the security community and the general public together along with media move so quickly to get the word out.
There is another silver lining. Marques of the OpenSSL Foundation says since the bug, they've gotten about $10,000 in checks.
What I think is remarkable about that is so many come from around the world, places like Micronesia, the Netherlands, Taiwan, typically in $5, $10, $20 amounts.
But Marques says given all the traffic on OpenSSL, that still doesn't cover the cost of maintenance. For NPR News, I'm Aarti Shahani in San Francisco.
You've probably heard of selfies, right? That's the slang term for an amateur self-portrait usually shared on social media. But you may not have heard of belfies. A belfie is a selfie that puts particular emphasis or focus on the subject's rear end. 20-year-old Jen Selter gained social media fame for her belfies, and she's now broken into the mainstream with a spotlight in the magazine Vanity Fair. While some credit her, who's white, with beginning a new trend toward body positivity in mainstream fashion, others say, wait, we've seen this before. Here to talk about that, Kara Brown. Her blog post titled, We Need to Talk About Jen Selter, has gone viral since it was republished on Jezebel. Kara, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So in your piece, you say you tried to ignore this woman for as long as possible. What about the Vanity Fair article actually tipped it for you?
I mean, the fact that she was being featured in a major fashion magazine was very different than getting, you know, thousands of likes on Instagram. This was sort of a stamp of approval. And, you know, as much as people like to talk about perhaps the diminishing influence of print magazines, you know, they're still very important and very relevant. And so seeing her on those pages to me was a different level than I'd seen her before.
And I guess your primary complaint is that when they gave examples of women who've become known for their rear end, none of them were women of color who kind of have been known for that for some time.
Yeah. You know, they reference, I think Elle magazine called her the next Kim Kardashian. And, you know, it's there were women before Kim Kardashian.
So you also mentioned a number of other, say, body traits or even styles that were trendy years and years ago, sometimes even centuries ago, mm-hmm. but they were associated with black women, and they mm-hmm. only become notable to a fashion magazine when a white woman begins to do it. Why? Can you name some of these trends for me?
You know, I think having full lips, which, you know, it's funny because some of the pushback for me is, well, you know, these aren't traits of only black people or white people. And that's true. But you also have to consider that, you know, in racist caricatures of black people, one of the things that they choose to emphasize or overemphasize are lips and someone's, you know, rear end. So I think when Angelina Jolie became very popular, there was this, you know, wave of full lips are amazing and look how beautiful she looks, and women were running out and getting, you know, whatever it is injected into their lips. And you just have to look around at all the other black women who've had this feature, not only had it, but celebrated it.
So who does it hurt? Why is it wrong?
I think it's you're erasing women of color from depictions of beauty and from being understood as being standards of beauty. So, you know, when you look at Jen Selter and you think, oh, well, you know, she looks great. And you know, and that's wonderful. But it's women of color are already underrepresented in fashion in the mainstream. And to take something that is largely associated with them and then just sort of put it on a white woman and say it's amazing, you know, it's not fair is not really the right word, but it's also just disingenuous.
So if this is a problem and causes body image problems, especially among women of color, who's to blame? Do you blame somebody like Jen Selter?
You know, I initially was very irritated with her, but taking a step back, you know, I don't hate her. I'm not mad at her. It's really sort of the systems that we're forced to operate within. And so, you know, if there was, I don't know what the masthead Vanity Fair looks like, but if there was a person of color who, you know, was high enough where they felt comfortable expressing their opinion, or, you know, if I was there, I probably would have said, hey, you know, we've seen this before. So I think it's also you don't have the people in these positions making decisions.
And should we instead maybe ignore it?
I mean, it's hard to ignore, and I don't think I should have to ignore, you know, things that are celebrated in our culture and things that I see all the time and things that I like. You know, I want to see myself and other types of people in them, and, you know, you can't, it's hard to ignore. You know, there are Black magazines, you know, you have Essence and Ebony, and those are great and amazing, but, you know, you also, why can't we be in Vanity Fair? Why can't we be in Vogue?
Kara Brown's blog is Yo, I'm Just Sayin'. Her post about Jen Selter was republished on Jezebel. She joined us from our New York bureau. Kara, thank you so much.
Thank you.
If you've ever sat through a never-ending meeting or a bad movie, you've probably had to resist the urge to look down at your watch. What time is it? So imagine if you could just reach down and feel the time on your wrist. Well, when Hyun-Soo Kim was in business school, he helped design a device that would let you do just that. It's not a watch, it's a timepiece, because you don't have to watch it to know the time. This timepiece, called the Bradley, was designed for the blind, but interestingly enough, it's being bought mostly by sighted people, who will now be able to check the time on the down low. Hyun-Soo joins me in our D.C. studios. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Who is Bradley and why did he need a new watch?
Yes, we named it after former naval officer Bradley Snyder, who lost his vision in 2011 while he was serving in Afghanistan as a bomb diffuser. But 1 year after the accident, he inspired us by competing in Paralympics in London, and he won 2 gold medals and 1 silver medal. So the Bradley timepiece is a wristwatch that you can tell time by either looking at it or by touching it. So my team started designing it after having realized that most of the mainstream watches and clocks require vision.
Can you hold it up and show me how it works and describe it?
Yes. So the time is indicated by the 2 ball bearings. So one ball bearing, it rotates on the surface, and the other ball bearing, it rotates on the side.
Well, it's a beautiful watch. It has, I guess, chrome markings.
And the face has raised hour markers so that people can feel the reference hours.
Now, weren't there already watches for the blind, some kind of Braille? I mean, I really don't have any idea.
Yeah, so there are 2 types of watches available for the blind. So one is talking watch. I brought it here. Basically, you press a button. It speaks out the time, but soon I realized that people who use this, they don't like pressing the button. First, everyone knows that you're checking time, and second, it draws attention to their disabilities. And the other alternative solution they have is analog watch. You open the glass cover to touch the minute and the hour hand. As you can imagine, it's very fragile, and when you touch them, you can very easily change position of the hands.
Are you surprised that so many sighted people are buying the watch?
While we were developing the concept, we wanted it to be for everyone. So we are very glad that people who are sighted also really liking it.
Hyun-Soo Kim is the founder of E1 Timepieces, the maker of the new Bradley watch. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Today in Your Health, we'll hear how the scribe, an ancient profession, is being revived in doctors' offices. But first, let's hear about how it affects children when the adults around them are absorbed in mobile devices. There's new research showing why that can be bad. Here's NPR's Patty Naiman.
Jenny Radesky is a pediatrician specializing in child development. When she worked at a clinic in a high-tech, savvy Seattle neighborhood, she started noticing how often parents ignored their kids in favor of a mobile device.
A mom kind of had a phone set up in the stroller, kind of in between her and her baby. And the baby kept making like faces and smiles at the mom, and she wasn't picking up any of it. She was just watching a YouTube video.
Radesky was so alarmed by what she saw, she decided she wanted to study the behavior further. After relocating to the Boston Medical Center, she and 2 other researchers spent 1 summer observing 55 different groups of parents and young children eating at fast food restaurants.
There was a good proportion of caregivers who brought out a device right away, looked at it, or, you know, typed or scrolled on it for most of the meal, you know, only putting it down intermittently.
In fact, 40 of the 55 parents used a mobile device during the meal, and many were more absorbed in the device than in the kids. A big mistake, says Radesky.
these face-to-face interactions are the primary way that children learn. They learn language, they learn about their own emotions and about how to regulate those emotions. They learn by watching us how to have a conversation, how to read other people's facial expressions.
And perhaps not surprisingly, when Radesky looked at patterns in what she and the other researchers observed, she found kids with parents who were most absorbed in their devices were more likely to act out trying to get their parents' attention.
You know, there was one with three boys sitting together that just started to enjoy each other's silliness. They were singing a song repetitively that the father kept saying, you know, enough, stop it, stop it. And they just would stop for a little while and then sing it again and louder and start to kind of, you know, mush their bodies into each other. One of them started climbing all over the barrier behind the booth that they were sitting in.
And the father just kept raising his voice, telling them to stop, and then going back to his cell phone. Catherine Steiner-Adair is a psychologist in Massachusetts who's written a book about parenting in the digital age and sees lots of parents, teens, and younger kids in her clinical practice.
When you're texting, when you're answering email, the part of your brain that's engaged is sort of the to-do list part of your brain. It often has a sense of urgency. And when we are engaged trying to accomplish something under a time pressure, we're much more irritable when we are interrupted.
And when parents focus on their digital world over their children, Steiner-Adair says, there can be deep emotional consequences for the child.
We are behaving in ways that certainly tell children they don't matter, they're not interesting to us, they're not as compelling as anybody or anything or any ping that would suddenly interrupt our time with them.
In research for her recent book, Steiner-Adair interviewed 1,000 children between the ages of 4 and 18, asking them about their parents' mobile device use.
And the language that came up over and over was sad, mad, angry, lonely.
One four-year-old called his dad's smartphone a stupid phone. Others recalled joyfully throwing their parents' phone into the toilet, putting it in the oven, or hiding it.
And one girl said, I feel like I'm just boring sometimes. I'm just boring my dad because he just will take any call, any text, any time, even on the ski lift.
Steiner-Adair says we don't know exactly how much these mini moments of disconnect between a parent and a child affect the child in the long term. But based on the stories she hears, she suggests that parents think twice before they pick up their mobile device when they're with their kids. Patty Namond, NPR News.